This is a show about individual experience and personal identity. There may be times when folks use identifying words or phrases that don't feel right to you. That's part of what we're exploring here. Please listen with an open heart, and as always, I welcome your polite, engaged feedback, and I encourage you to continue the conversation in your own life and with your own community. Welcome to Query.
Hey, Queeros. So sorry to keep doing this. I'm on set in Vancouver. And today's episode is a re-release of my chat with Caspar Turkile from a few... God, was it actually years ago? Heavens to Betsy. I got a bunch of new tour dates. They are all up at CameronEsposito.com. But just so you know where I will be heading, I will be coming to Seattle, Burlington, Vermont, Boston, Denver, DC, Dallas, Austin, Houston, LA... New York and Chicago are coming soon. I can't wait to see you on the road. CameronEsposito.com for tickets.
I've been feeling wrong, but I'm still holding on. Darling, I know it's careless.
Well, I always have guests introduce themselves. Will you introduce yourself?
Yeah. Hi, everyone. Hi. I'll do that again.
I mean, you're killing it.
Just nailing it.
You're killing it. That's it. That's all you needed to. Hi, everyone. Yeah. It's very, very warm and welcoming introduction. Let's hear.
I was like, let me have a sip of tea. There's going to be some chat. No, okay. Let me do that again.
Yeah.
Hey, Cameron. I'm Casper. I'm the co-host of Harry Potter and the Sacred Text and the author of a new book, The Power of Ritual. And I'm calling in from my hometown of Forest Row in Sussex. So I'm in England.
Oh,
and I've been like, I've been gallivanting around fields and just like hugging trees and being so happy to be in nature after 6 months of New York City during lockdown.
Right. How was your travel to England?
So
terrifying?
I was so nervous about it. And it was the most comfortable flight of my life because there was literally no one in it. I slept on four seats. There was no lines. I just sat in my seat the whole time and got off and went straight home. So I felt very safe. Oh, there was a lot of mask. What else? I was going to say I put on like sunglasses, but I didn't. But I had an eye mask, so I slept a bunch. Yeah, it was very comfortable.
Wow. How long are you in Essex?
I'm here for four.
Did you say Sussex?
Essex. Sussex. Yeah. I was going to say.
Who
like,
cares? No, yeah. I'm just kidding. I do.
Well,
it's from. Yeah.
No, we make but, like Essex is the American Jersey. So, like, it's a whole.
Oh, my God.
Thing.
Well,
yeah.
I'm so sad you're not from there. The American
exactly.
Jersey.
But it's been really good because I don't know about you, but this has just been really tough. These last 6 months, it's been super tough. And I called my mom like in tears a couple months ago. I was like, do you think I could come home? So she was like, sure.
Yeah. I mean, well, that's part of the reason I wanted to talk to you is so some stuff that how do you even say this? I think there was a certain, you know, I can read queerness into Harry Potter. I'm somebody who was raised in a certain faith tradition and felt like organized religion no longer served me. And then my partner was super into specifically the Harry Potter audiobooks that she grew up listening to.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know if you've like the Jim Dale ones where he's doing all of the voices.
All the voices.
They're so beautiful. And I think that up until very recently, you know, there was a sort of, I know what's going on for J.K. Rowling, and this text seems so in opposition to that, that like I can sort of hold the text and not hold the author. But that being said, her most recent round of like, of terrifying statements that put, you know, our trans family members in direct danger has really changed my view on the series. And then also it's like, oh, and of course, like, it's incredibly racist that, you know, all like Cho Chang, like, let's not name a character that when that's the only, you know, like,
constantly talking about how there's like one black character and that character is, you know, always described as black. So it makes you realize that everybody who isn't described is like default white. And, you know, every other thing, the way that house elves are talked about and like how troubling that is. I mean, there's a whole... And you
once you stop listing,
it
doesn't end. That's
There's no thing. End. Yes.
Exactly.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
Right.
And I know that that's also something that you've talked about. You've talked about all these issues on your podcast, Harry Potter and the Sacred Text. But I bought your book because I am trying to address some of the stuff that you're talking about. Through, I don't know, like an exploration of spirituality. It's very weird. I'm having a very weird time.
Isn't it strange? Like I had such, I mean, I didn't grow up with any religious background and the word God was just like weird and stupid for me as a kid, especially once I came out, I was like, oh, religion is either cruel or like useless and irrelevant. And it was just so far away from my world. But then against every instinct that I had, there came a point, and I'd been really involved as a climate activist. I was really involved in mobilizing young people around this international climate deal. And the talks failed in 2009. There were these big international talks and they didn't lead anywhere. And I, you know, I had friends who were like on hunger strike for 41 days. Like we were all in on this organizing. And when it fell short, I looked around me and I was like, I can never risk my heart like this again in a movement, in something that I care for. And I looked at the leaders who I most admired in social justice movements in history. And I was like, how did they keep going? Because they risked way more than I ever did. They struggled much longer than I ever have. Like, how on earth do you keep going? And I kept seeing this like spirituality show up. And it totally confused me because I was like, how... First of all, as like a gay person, how am I going to do that? And then secondly, is like, I don't have a religious tradition. Like I didn't grow up with anything. Like, how am I going to do that? And so I've been on this like exploration for the last, I'd say like 10 years at this point. And I don't have any answers, Cameron, but I can tell you what I've been seeing from my journey. But it's, yeah. I think more and more of us are sitting in this exploration phase, trying to piece together something that feels authentic and rooted, relevant, but still like anchored in something. So I'm really curious to hear from you. Like, what are you discovering?
Well, I want to get to that, but I want to ask you some questions about the climate activism stuff, because I knew that about you. And I think it's a, like an under sort of reported identity. Like, I don't know a lot of people that I think would identify sort of first as climate activists. Cause that's a very, anyway, 2009, how old would you have been leading up to that?
I was 23. So I'd been really involved in climate stuff from like 20 to 23, 24. Like those 3-4 years was when I was most involved.
What happened at 20 that this is the path that you followed?
Well, so I was really radicalized by reading Naomi Klein's No Logo when I was like 17, 18. And this is an amazing book. If you haven't read it, it's really a story of the 1990s about how big corporations were using, really slave labor, from people working in the developing world with, you know, no labor conditions, no environmental conditions for the kind of brands like Nike and The Gap, like all these big brands of the 1990s that everyone loved. And so it was such an awakening for me as a child of great privilege to see that the world was way more unfair than I had ever understood. And so I started digging into these kind of global trade issues and started to get involved first in my university as a student, kind of making our campus fair trade and then getting involved with like recycling campaigns and all sorts of things that were really about the campus. And then I had this extraordinary experience when I was one of 20 young people from around the world that got to go on this 10-day Arctic voyage. So we were literally on a research ship going to the North Pole to like learn from climate scientists to see the impact of global warming on these glaciers and to see the rise of water levels and what that would mean, not just for the Arctic, but for the whole world. And my parents are both Dutch and like a third of Holland is below sea level. So all of this felt very, very real. Like looking at these maps of what's going to happen as sea level rises, I was like, oh, that's where my friend lives and now it's underwater. And so it wasn't a radicalization. It was more of a personalization. Like climate is such an issue that sometimes feels far away, either sometimes like far away geographically or far away in terms of time. And this experience like made it feel so real and so immediate that it lit a fire under my ass. And I was just like, screw it. Like, I'm gonna get involved as much as I can. And I saw these other young people from India and Canada and Australia and all around the world who were mobilizing young people around these global agreements, these moments when countries came together to set targets for themselves and kind of build a structure of accountability. And I was like, that's where I can get involved. And so that's really when I kind of took on the label of a climate activist. And some friends and I set up an organization to mobilize young people. And, you know, we failed in all sorts of ways. But like each of those people who are involved at that kind of level of organizing are still doing amazing work, contributing to activism in all sorts of ways today. And I'm like, yeah, those people never leave your heart. It's a powerful thing.
I think that beyond just what you're talking about geographically or time-wise, a distance, I think that it's also another, for me anyway, I think my relationship to, it's like, there's no doubt in my mind what I think, you know, there's no doubt in my mind what the facts are, but it's also, it's a topic that seems so large
yes.
that I think that
yes.
it can feel very like, I don't even know what the access point is. Like, it's like, you know, I mean, besides personal responsibility. So,
right.
you know, I think for, you know, for me, it's like, okay, so I recycle, I, you know,
right.
drive a Prius or whatever it is, you know, but what you're talking about, I think the reason that I wanted to ask about it is also that it just feels like, and I have no idea what the UK is like or Sussex or where you were going to university. But I just think that also, interesting to think that, you know, that you could be that involved, like to think I can join up, you know, that's also interesting
right.
to take that step. And
totally.
And
it's one of the most challenging things about climate as an issue. And in some ways, you know, it's similar to homophobia or sexism or racism in that like the problem is so embedded in everything that it feels like any lever that you pull is never going to address the kind of systemic nature of the
right.
issue. And so, yes, there's personal responsibility, but I'm always very, you know, it's so insufficient. As you said, like you have to think about the structural things like where is, you know, my money being invested? Whose electricity am I using? Like all of that stuff. But really, even if all of us citizens did that individual stuff, it still wouldn't be enough to shift government action. And so that's why I was really involved in kind of lobbying politicians and like using the media. But the thing that I got to was that even if we moved policies, it would still not deal with the fundamental issues, which is like the paradigm we live in that says nature is something separate from us humans. Like we live in a society where we see animals and plants and like the sky and water as things that are resources that are there to be used, whether it's meat for our food or like land for our buildings, rather than seeing the natural world as something that we are part of and that's something that is sacred. Because if we did, and there are cultures that do this and have done this, that would totally change the frame with which we make decisions. So for example, if you look at a lake and you're like, oh, this is a resource, well, we can pollute it to 60% because then we'll still be able to use it in the way that we need to use it. And if we see the lake as something that is inherently worthy and full of dignity and is not ours to use as we choose it, but has its own sanctity, like You wouldn't just go and pollute at 60%. You'd figure out a way to do what we wanted to do without polluting it. And there's this is starting to happen, which is really exciting. There's now a river in New Zealand that has its own legal rights. And so when decisions are being made, isn't that cool? It's like yes. The river has a say about what's going to happen. And it's like, of course that should happen. And of course, there are indigenous cultures that have always carried that kind of mentality. And you see it with the bushfires in California right now. You know, the experts now tell us that it's healthy to have some burning once in a while in small doses to keep the forests healthy and resilient. Guess what happened when colonizers arrived in what we now call California? They banned that kind of burning because they said it was destructive. Well, the people who were native to that place were saying like, no, this is what it needs to be healthy. And so when we lose that kind of wisdom, when we lose that kind of relationship with the natural world, we get screwed. And so it's that kind of paradigm and that kind of connection to place and people that I'm really interested in cultivated. And that's kind of how I ended up thinking about this question of spirituality and rituals, because those are the ways in which we reconnect in that deeper way.
Yeah. I mean, I'll listen to you. Keep going. Like that's beautiful. And it does make, you know, clear. I'm sure anybody who just heard that is now no longer shocked to find out that you pivoted from climate activist to then enrolling in Harvard Divinity School. And
well, I see them as connected. That's yes. That's why, you know, and honestly, it took me a while to understand that they were connected, because I was also hurting, you know, like having failed so much at something you cared so much about. Like, I really believed the narrative that we were saying, which was like, if we don't get these talks right, like the human race is extinct, you know, and of course that's not entirely true. There's going to be huge impacts, but yeah, bringing those two things together is really important to me. I'm sorry, you know, I interrupted you.
No, you didn't. You know, we're talking about this at like a really interesting time for me too, because I don't know exactly when this episode will come out. Like maybe it will come out Monday, but maybe in a couple weeks. And last night was the final night of the Republican National Convention. So yeah. For anybody that's listening, and I was just talking to my partner, Katie, before getting on here. And literally, I was saying to Jordan and Matt, who are producing, like, actually burst into tears because I realized that Don Jr. is probably going to have a political career. Like, I don't know why I didn't think of that previously. But I really have been thinking about this president as, like, this, you know, sort of insidious force to hopefully move, you know, out of the, not that he is the center of our problems, but that I just personally feel so upset.
Yeah.
Seeing his face, hearing his voice, and hearing the rhetoric that he uses. Like, it's just, it's so baseline upsetting. And I just had the thought about like, oh my God, you know, and watching the RNC, it was mostly his kids and his family. And he's turned it into turned the Republican Party into like a family business. And so, which is not the first time that has happened, but for me, it feels, it's so painful to have this person leading the country. And I think that it does sort of relate to what you're talking about, because for me, like, I graduated from college and then marriage equality happened in Massachusetts, where I lived in this at that time, that same week. And then I got my first job working in comedy that same week professionally. I did like another day job for a while. I just worked like two jobs and 80 hours a week. But I was always moving. You know, I felt like we were moving in a certain direction. Right?
That sense and of like, progress, right? Yeah.
Yes. And obviously, this is not the only time that, like, then we've had this huge swing back. But I just think because I felt so personally impactful, like, I have this job where I get to speak my mind, and I felt like I would walk into rooms and people would think something different about me. You know, they would think something about queer folks, or they'd think something about, you know, women, or they'd think something about gender nonconforming people, or whatever it is. And I felt like, man, I'm really like making strides, you know? And I think just had an experience of like the wind, you know, leaving my sails a little bit after the last election, where I just felt like, oh, I guess, you know, it's not me. maybe it's us, but I'm exhausted. And
big time.
It's from that place that I, you know, first worked my ass off to make like an hour of stand-up about sexual assault. And then when that was released, was like, oh, that actually didn't fix it. Like, I don't feel better. I'm proud that I did that thing, but it also didn't shift, you know, culture.
I recognize so much in what you're saying, because I think many of us are raised with a sense of a story that it's going to get better. I mean, literally, especially for queer kids, like that sense of it gets better was literally the tagline.
It's going to get better, and also that I can make it better, which is also, I would say, a very privileged position to come from. Like,
hugely.
Fully had to reckon with, like, who the fuck do I think I am, you know? Right. But, I mean, I'll just leave that part as a whole other thing.
As a given, right, and the responsibility.
Better, and it gets exactly. better based on me, Cameron Esposito, the person who can make it better. Okay. All right. Well,
but it's both of those things, right? Like none of us can, you know, we are all needed and none of us is going to do it alone, right? It's like
yes.
that both, it's
sure.
that both and. But I really think that we have been raised with that sense of we're in a story, it's going to get better. And, you know, I was reading this fantastic book, White Rage by Carol Anderson, and where she basically outlines that, like, as you know, as we seem to make progress towards liberation, racial equity, racism itself becomes even more like strategic and smart at fitting itself into whatever we've built to replace the thing that was broken. And so I feel like that's true on other issues as well. When we seem to make progress, you know, the poison of all the things that were broken before somehow find their way in. And I think in some ways it has to do with the fact that, like, humans exist, right? Like, we hold all of that icky stuff inside of us, at least I do. And so whenever we're involved with building something, unless we're tackling these issues on an outer level and an inner level, we're going to recreate the same shit in whatever we're building, right? Whether it's, you know, the relationship with the natural world, or whether it's interhuman relationships around race or gender or whatever it is. And so, you know, it's so often in conversations around spirituality, you know, you kind of end up in this escape narrative of like, okay, well, we'll leave the problems of the world. You just focus on you, or like self-care, or, you know, it gets kind of packaged in this way of like, you just fix yourself. And it's always both, right? Like, it's that inner piece and the outer piece, and both are necessary if we're going to see the world and live a life that, you know, that we feel is possible. Or as Charles Eisenstein says, that the more beautiful world our hearts know is possible. I love that phrase. Like, that's where we want to be.
Yeah, I feel you. I mean, I think actually that is, it's actually the opposite of that that has piqued my interest in.
Hmm.
Well, so, you know, when I was like a strictly religious person, I was into liberation theology. I was into political direct action. It's just that some of that political direct action was confused. You know, I again, we're like recording this the same week that a bunch of rhetoric, an actual nun in habit, appeared at the RNC. I can't explain how bonkers that is to anybody who doesn't know, appearing in habit. Like, a lot of times if you see a minister, maybe they'll have a Roman collar on,
right,
which is that little white piece that goes between stand up, like a mock turtleneck collar, essentially. But, or if
I love
you see
it,
a nun,
like, priest is bad turtleneck. I like that. That's
yeah. Like, that's like that. You might see that, right? Or if you see a nun often appearing in a space that is political, like, you would more likely today see them in like a like skirt suit, like a blazer type of thing. But a nun in habit is like, that's like the Pope appearing in the fucking Pope hat to be like, I stand with this president specifically. It's pretty extreme. And
And we had, I mean, there was a nun who spoke for the Democratic Convention, Simone Campbell, who runs an amazing organization called Network, which is all about justice work in all sorts of ways.
Yes.
She led the Nuns on the Bus project that you may remember, yes, around economic inequality. And,
yes,
and most nuns in America today, like, this is so random, but I have recently befriended a couple of nuns and they are incredible. But most nuns in America don't wear the habit, like you were saying.
They wear like...
normal clothes.
It's like a professional sort of teacher, yeah, outfit.
Yes. Well, like, exactly. It's like a sweater, right? Like, it's, yeah, it's like a cardigan when it gets, yes, a little chilly. Yeah. Because for most nuns in America, the choice they made is to a life of service. And when you think about, you know, hospital systems, education systems in the US, a lot of them were founded by nuns who were wanting to serve, you know, folks who were at the very edges, the folks at the margins. But there are a smaller number of nuns who still wear the habit, who are often very, very conservative in their theology. And that was one of the sisters who was on the stage. And it's, I mean, the narratives that were coming out of the Republican convention were just so, I mean, they're dangerous. They're
well, like specifically,
actively, yeah,
about abortion, because,
yes,
I think about it as, you know, when because of what we're talking about right now, I'm actually probably one of like the very few people on the planet who has both attended a pro-life rally that was headlined by Sister Helen Prejean.
Whoa.
And also hosted the Planned Parenthood National Dinner. I'm not sure if there is another person who's done both of those things, but I have.
You have insights, Cameron. This is valuable.
Yes, I have insights. And I think it's to watch that happening at the RNC. I also listened to this really great podcast that's called 1A. It's an NPR podcast that I would really recommend to any of our listeners. But and they had some women on who are like young women that are voting Republican that are doing it specifically and only on the issue of abortion. And,
wow,
and that blows my mind. I mean, I was raised in a climate where you're getting a lot of confusing messaging about abortion, and also where it's one of the only things that is all wrong. Like, there's no way to justify it. It's just wrong. And,
yep,
that's because, you know, what, anyway, I could go off on that, but to think that is still where some people are at, like that you could pick up a newspaper or walk down the street and people have masks on, and that your number one issue is, yeah, like that to me, that makes me feel like I'm in the weeds in a way that I didn't realize, you know, that I was with how some people are experiencing 2020. Yeah. Like, yeah, this is what's going on for you. You're like, this nun.
Well,
this nun is the difference maker for you.
It also speaks to the like seriously fucked up way in which religion can work. I mean, one of the most destructive ideas I think out there around religion is that faith is about certainty, right? It's about having the right answers. It's about holding the line. It's about, you know, not even questioning something. When in my understanding, faith is about a hopefulness in the face of uncertainty. And it's about embracing questions and doubt and learning and exploring and listening, but with a loving conviction at the heart of who we are. And when that's twisted into this certainty, I mean, that's how people die. Like, it's so violent. I mean, sometimes we think about spirituality as something that's like nice and interesting, but like it shapes the very foundations of who we are. And if it's dangerous, if it's destructive, it can kill you, or it'll kill other people. And it's so important we get it right.
Do you go to a church? Do you ascribe to a specific faith or religion?
Why are you coming at me, Cameron?
Fucking tell me where that church is and tell me everything it's ever stood for.
No, I don't. I don't go to a congregation. And I struggle with this because I really believe in community. I really believe in communal practices. I didn't grow up going to church. And so in the idea of like sitting in pews is like, kills my spirit. It's just like, why can I not look at someone's face? I'm just looking at someone's back of the head. And partly because I grew up with these different influences. Like I grew up in England, so there's always going to be a little Anglican kind of Church of England vibe, especially the choral music. Love that. But I also grew up in this like kind of pagan-y school, which had a lot of like nature rituals. It was a Waldorf school. And so, you know, there's lots of like dancing around a maypole and like digging a cow horn into the earth full of cow dung and then digging it up the next year and, you know, all of that kind of stuff. And then my parents are Dutch, so there's all these like Dutch traditions. And so wherever I go, if it's one place, there's never going to be like the fullness of me that feels like it belongs there. It's always going to be part of me. And so I end up kind of falling between the cracks a little bit. And so I end up kind of creating places with other people that feel like they can speak more to my authentic experience of spirituality, which is really imperfect. You know, I wish it was different, but that's where I'm at right now. But I do have both practices for me personally that are really important. Like I do a tech Sabbath, which is just so central to my kind of sense of connection to spirit and to a kind of groundedness. And then I have a confession group where basically about all this.
You do a tech Sabbath. Hang on 1 second. I think I know what this means, but I want to ask.
Do like, it.
What day is that?
So I do it on Friday nights. So in a minute, we're recording on a Friday. When it gets dark, I turn off my phone, I turn off my laptop, and I literally hide them. And I light a candle and I sing a little camp song that I learned in summer camp. And for me, that's the moment when I like cross the bridge from the time of work and like stress and trying to make things happen to what Abraham Joshua Heschel, the great Jewish theologian, described as a palace in time. And I love that now, especially during COVID when we can't move around so much, that like we're entering into this different like time space and it's beautiful and it's supposed to be a taste of heaven. So on the Sabbath in Jewish tradition, not only are you supposed to be with loved ones and like sing and be merry, you're also supposed to have sex because like it's supposed to be the most delicious time of the week. And it's not like a time of rest and recovery so that you can go at it again on Monday morning. It's supposed to be that the work week was so that you can have this time of relaxation and joy and connection. So it's for me, that was such a reframe to be like, oh, this isn't about resting per se, but of course that happens. It's about delight. It's about like enjoying the fact that I'm alive. So I fucking love Sabbath time. It's like,
So you do it from Friday night till when?
So you do it, traditionally you do it for 25 hours because it's so good that you want to do one extra hour in addition to the full day. So you do Friday sundown to Saturday night sundown. That's kind of the traditional way. I mean, listen, sometimes it's like 4 p.m. and I'm like, okay, I feel good. And like, I don't make it all the way through, but that's the way that I practice it. And it's like a real anchor, especially, you know, before COVID, I did move around a lot. And so to have that ritual every week was really grounding. Also, because some people are amazing at daily rituals. I find that much, much harder. Like to have a consistent morning, I wish I had that kind of discipline. But once a week, I can really do.
Oh, that is actually, that's a relief to hear, you know? I mean, I certainly, I also know what you mean about creating intentional community around you. And I have that, which is awesome. But it is, and I know in your book, you're also talking about people like using CrossFit as, I mean, not today, not on this particular day of 2020, are people using CrossFit as their,
right.
as their like spiritual and, you know, soul hub. But, do you have places like that?
I mean, for me, singing is huge. Like when I sing with other people, I kind of forget that I exist. I like melt into something bigger than myself, which is a real relief because being in my head can get a little tiring. I have a choir that I sing with, but the folks I really love to sing with are kind of spread out, and we get together a couple times a year and sing together for like a long weekend, which is huge.
What kind of choir do you sing with?
Oh, yeah. It's the Jalopy Chorus in Red Hook. it's singing folk music. So that's the music I love to sing. So we sing folk music from the Caucasus, from Georgia, from obviously all around the US, but also folk music from South Africa, folk music from Corsica in Europe. So all sorts of different traditions, which are often polyphonic. So they have multiple harmonies. And that's, I love that harmony singing. And it's, for me, it's not singing to perform. Like, it's not about showing off, like, hey, like, we're on The Voice, you know, like that kind of singing. It's about the experience of singing. It's about being in that moment, hearing each other, because we can't all talk at the same time, but we can all sing together. And like literally when you're breathing together and singing together, your heartbeats start to beat in time with another. So there's this kind of like cosmic connection that happens to me in singing. So it's, yeah, that for me. And I grew up singing a lot at home. So it kind of makes me feel, yeah, it just makes me feel really good. And it's something that I that is really attractive for me about religious communities, because so often now, like, you're together with a group of people and the only song everyone knows is fucking Wagon Wheel. So it's like we just have an absence of folk culture. You know what I mean? Like we need those songs to feel connected to each other. And then if you think about the way in which song is being used in protest, it's not just entertainment, it's an organizing tool. It gives people courage. It gives people sense of discipline to stay in formation, right? All of that stuff. So yeah, singing is like super powerful.
Yeah. I mean, I know the feeling that you're describing, because that's what stand-up feels like to me. I mean, it's not, you can't all talk at the same time, but,
you can laugh together.
Right. And also, you can mind meld. I mean, that is an experience that I when it's going well, I always feel that way. And when it's not going well, I don't feel that way. And then that's terrible.
Right.
But I don't even mean like that I'm like not, I think maybe from the outside, you wouldn't necessarily know, because it doesn't have to do with bombing or anything like that. Because sometimes, I mean, at this point, I rarely bomb, except on Zoom shows. Very easy to bomb on a Zoom show.
Oh my God.
But
yeah.
But rough. It's more so just that there's like a performance, and then there's this sort of elevated version that is
transcendent. Yeah.
Performance. How, and transcendence, yeah.
Would you, like, when do you know that it's at that kind of spiritual level? Like, when that connection with an audience is at that?
I mean, I'll
that.
Tell you the most fucked up story that is in... So I also wrote a book. This is the end of my book. So sorry to ruin this for anybody who hasn't listened or hasn't read it. But look, the rest of it's good. There was... This is like the moment that I knew that I wasn't making this up. I was performing in New York, actually at the basement of the Ace Hotel that is like in, I think, like Midtown Manhattan.
Midtown, right.
And it was a year that had just opened or something like that. So it was like very
swanky.
We can't even believe we're here. And there's the front row is a couch, you know, that sort of show, right?
Right.
And I had been on a hike with one of my friends that day, and I wasn't doing material. I was just talking about going on a hike with one of my friends, and she was talking about having a kid, and I was talking about how the fuck could you ever know that that's something you want to do? And it was going very well with the audience, and I felt this, I visualized like I was a tree. You're going to love this. This is exactly up your alley. I started to have this like sort of vision that like I was a tree and my roots were going back down through the floor, and then they were coming up and like connecting into all of the people, and that we were all like rooted, like actually networked together physically, energetically through the floor. And I finished the set and it went really well. One of the people who was sitting on the couch in the front row was Reggie Watts, who now is the band leader on James Corden. At the time, he was like a beloved comic. So like I knew who he was. He was ahead of me. But he was not like a super mega famous person. He was like somebody that you, like a comedy nerd would, ultimate comic sort of a person. So he's sitting in the front row and I'm doing so well, but also he's laughing at me, which is like, oh, what a dream. And then afterwards he comes up to me. And of course, like if you know anything about Reggie Watts, he's already very like groovy. And he said, I like loved that performance. I mean, I think what I loved the most was that moment where like you were a tree and it was like you were going down. I had not talked about this on stage. I had not mentioned that this is how I felt. And he's like, it was like you were connected to everybody. And I was like,
holy shit.
Yeah, man. That's exactly what it was like. And anyway, that's what it feels like. And
It gives me tingles, Cameron, because it's...
I know! And it's so... And it's like, it's that tangible that another comic who clearly gets the same thing out of it when it's going well could identify it.
And here's the thing. Like, literally the word religion translates as rebinding. Like, spiritual practices are there to remind us what is already true, which is that we are connected in exactly that way that you were describing, right? And whether it's dancing together or singing together or being in a comedy show together, like the moments when we remember that we have that rootedness together, like that's when we're actually conscious of what's true. And all of these practices don't make something happen. They're just reminding us of what's already there and that we keep forgetting. And that's why I love spiritual practices, because it can be anything. It can be baseball. It can be like cuddling your kid, right? Whatever helps you remember that, that's what you can build a ritual around. That's a spiritual practice waiting to be made, you know, real in your life.
Right. Oh God, that's it's such a good way of saying it. It's such a good way of describing it. Also before, you know, I'm used to having that experience in stand-up, but I also am used to... The unfortunate thing about it is I have to be the boss of that experience.
Yeah.
Like I'm the one that's setting it up. And I will say that, you know, to the point that we were making earlier, it's like, then I just got to this place in my life where I was just like, how can I have that experience, but I'm not creating it? Because at that point I was just feeling like, I kind of want to be part of the team, you know, like I'm sick of being the boss of the thing. And, last year, I started going to dance classes because my friend Tatiana had just invited me to go. She invited me to go a couple times. She's cool. She's like somebody I really think is like a good hang. And I thought she wouldn't suggest something that was like absolutely the worst. But I also felt like some body shame and some like gender related shame were
for real.
You know, I had taken dance classes as a little kid and I was like always feeling so humiliated. And I just was like, I don't know if I can do this. Like, I don't know if I can show up. But I like texted her. And that's the reason I'm bringing this up is that also sometimes it's very hard to join up. Like when you were talking about being part of a chorus, I was like, but how did you show up the first time? Like, that's what I thought in my mind is like that just seems impossible. And so what I did was, you know, I found that buddy who was doing the thing that I thought I could trust. And I texted her, like, for some accountability, you know, to say, I'm going to come meet you tomorrow morning. And, like, she was so smiley and happy to see me. And then, you know, and then I felt like I could go. Because for me, it's like the first time is the time that's 100%. That bridge. It's like I'm never going to cross. If I'm not, like, I'm either never going to cross it or I'm going to get to the other side and then I can do it, forever.
100%. And that's true for all of us. I mean, again, this is one of my frustrations with the current like culture around spirituality is like that it's some sort of personal journey that you do on your own. And it's like, hello, like, of course, everyone learns to do something because someone else helped them, right? And so, and we're always part a teacher, right? Like Tatiana's bringing you along with her. And then we're also a student when Tatiana's going somewhere for the first time and someone else is bringing her, right?
Yeah.
And so like, we're always both of those roles. And it's like, can we be conscious of that? Can we lean into the moments when we can bring someone else into something that we love doing? And then can we be brave and go with someone else into something that's new for us? I love that. I love that. And you know, sometimes we, like, as I said, I grew up singing a lot. So for me, it's very easy to like start a song and get everyone going. But like something else, oh my God, like, oh God. And if anything involving like physical exercise, I'm like, oh Jesus, help me. It's just like, that's where all my stuff shows up. And I'm like, oh, and I need help. Or like some sort of great Madonna playlist and Madonna will help me through.
Yeah. Well, so for somebody that is so sensitive to this connection, and I am having this experience in, I would have said I was an introvert because sometimes I just find myself like exhausted. And I thought that I was exhausted by other people and that I like needed to recharge my batteries alone.
Yeah.
But I actually think it's that I put too much of my life into a category of work. Like all of my friends, but before the last couple of years, all of my friends were actually coworkers that I was just scooting into a friendship area. And all of my time, you know, I could work 7 days a week. So something I've noticed is that if I have a little more separation, then that's not necessarily as true. But what I'm finding in pandemic times is that I actually am totally an extrovert. Not necessarily that I need to, like, I hate a party. Party is still not my default.
Yes.
I like a dinner party.
Yes.
But a party's, but I do love to sort of be in the mix. Like, I love to go to a bookshop, walk around, and just sort of absorb the energy of being
so
there.
So good. Yes.
So how are you, a person who's so sensitive to how we are all networks of trees, how are you dealing with this time of separation? What are you doing?
It sucks so much.
Yeah.
It sucks so much. I'm a huge extrovert. I'm massively oriented towards other people. And I love learning and being and vibing and all the things. Like during this pandemic, especially in the first few months, once a week I would cycle to the Brooklyn Bridge and just like stand there and look at the cars and be like, there's other people. Like I just need to like soak up something. So it's been really tough. It's been really tough. And, you know, we decided early on to make a little pod with some neighbors in our building. And we didn't know folks at all well, but we were like, listen, we've got to have some human contact. So there's a couple of folks and we would have dinner once in a while or play Mario Kart or like something. And that's been a huge help. But the thing that's been really revealing for me is as someone who has friends, you know, obviously I moved countries, I have friends on the West Coast, East Coast, then back in Europe. My life has been designed for a lifestyle that is both environmentally unsustainable, but also like not corona resistant, you know, like, or any sort of future where locality is going to become super important again. And it's maybe really think about how can I think about friendships that are more local, that are not dependent on, you know, work travel or whatever else that is happening that allows me to have dinner with someone in San Francisco or allows me to see dear friends in Boston. So that's kind of opened up some big questions for me in terms of like long-term life planning, it's just not easy. So that's one of the big questions I'm
sitting with. What you're saying. So does that look like, you know, redoubling your efforts to local community? Like, is that when you think about that,
which locality do I choose, right? My immediate family is all in England. My professional life is in America. You know, are those two things going to come towards a clash at some point where I really have to choose one or the other? Mostly I'm ignoring that question and eating Haagen-Dazs. So that has been my
strategy. I relate to that question. My family lives all over the place too. And my parents live in Chicago. My siblings live, one lives in South America, one lives in the American South. And my partner's family all lives in Europe. Yeah. So I do think that you're absolutely right to point out the environmental, unsustainability. My job is, you know, I'm like always a platinum medallion. Like I'm always like, the person that flies so much that Delta's like, hey man, great to see you. Like thanks. You know.
Thanks for being here, Cameron. We're so glad to see you.
It's like so nice that you didn't buy a house, but instead spent this money on airplane tickets. You know, so I have like you, I have friends all over the place, but I also do have you know, family all over the place. And weirdly, as a queer person, sort of resisted the friends or family thing for a very long time. I don't know what that is. I think it maybe it's job related. I don't know what it is. I like really still was like, family is family. Maybe it's being Italian. I don't know. I'm very Italian, but
Well, and for me, it has a lot to do with the fact that my, you know, my coming out was exceptionally easy, although my therapist says, don't discount the pain just because it was easier than other people's. But nonetheless, like, I was so lucky to not have to experience a great breach with my family, for example. And so that helps. Yeah.
I mean, my coming out was actually terrible, but yeah. I mean, it was very bad. But I had this weird sort of experience of, like, I moved to Boston and was going to school there. Came out, it was terrible. All my family was living in a bunch of different places. My older sister was not. And then we all sort of collapsed back into Chicago. Mm. And there was this reunification time as adults that I think maybe some people didn't get to experience. Or maybe a younger generation is having this because people are like moving back in with parents. But for me, what happened was I ended up living on the same block with my siblings as adults. We all lived like down in the city in different apartments on the same block. And then my folks sort of oriented toward our neighborhood. And it was like this example of maybe this is how things will turn out. And then we all exploded back out. And I think that, I don't think that that was actually sustainable. Like, I don't think we all meant to sort of recreate our family unit as adults. But I think that it was a reaction to this huge rift that happened when I came out. Like, I think everybody felt so fucked up about it that they were like, wait, can we go back in time and be kids again? And like,
let's do
all
this
live
over.
Together.
Yeah.
And Right.
And learn to live into a new constellation of family in which everyone can also be themselves. You know, that's such a precious, I'm so glad you had that time. And it's, as you say, it's not necessarily forever, but to have that safety, kind of that launch pad from which you can all then go out into the world again is really beautiful. Knowing that you can come back as well, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So you are in Sussex, and then where are you going to go from there?
I'll be back in New York in September. So I'm here for just over a month. I just don't think I'll be able to travel this winter. So this is the moment. Yeah. Yeah, to do that. Yeah.
Well, I'm trying to think of what else I want to ask you about.
Do we want to talk about Potter in any way?
Yeah, I was going to just like selfishly ask you some. No, I was just going to selfishly ask you about like some like tell me how to live my life. But yes, we can talk about Potter.
No. I don't need to go there. I just you mentioned it up top.
No,
I'm so happy
just
to talk like life stuff. That feels great.
Yeah. Well, I think that. So it's tough. I can ask you how you feel about this. I feel that. Like, she also did damage to queer folks. It's totally fucked up to introduce the Dumbledore story with, like, absolutely no payoff. Like, that's really harmful and damaging. But I also think that as two cis people, it's this combination that... I listened to the episode of your show where you had a conversation... where you had like a trans guest, and then you had a bunch at the end of it, you had a bunch of people call in who are trans identified, and you just played their messages. I would actually recommend to anybody that listens to this podcast that did grow up loving the Potter series. Do you remember the title of this episode? I'm sure you know the one I'm talking about.
Yeah, I mean, it's called an outpost, I think, about J.K. Rowling's transphobia. So it's one of the recent, like, four or five episodes in the Harry Potter and the Sacred Text feed. We interviewed Jackson Bird and then hear from a bunch of trans and non-binary listeners.
It's pretty powerful because not just what Jackson has to say, but then also I really appreciated that you just set it up so that trans folks could talk without any commentary, feedback, or even support, like, because these are just, you know, folks whose voices can stand alone. But how do you, you know, as a cis person, understand what your job role, you know, how are you understanding that right now?
You know, it's been really, it's weird. It's like two roads traveling at the same time. On one road, I feel so grateful that we have never oriented our conversations around J.K. Rowling. I'm interested in the Potter books because there are so many people who love them who don't fit into a traditional religious home. That's why I care about them.
Which is exactly, I just have to say, which is exactly why her stance is so infuriating. Because she is speaking directly to a community that has been brutalized, murdered, made homeless, like
legit,
and ostracized from their families because of, like, that is exactly the person who would then find spirituality in the Harry Potter series. It is so cruel. Her cruelty is so strong. It's so cruel.
She's colonizing the fandom in this, like, such a destructive and selfish, honestly, way. So that's the second row, which is, like, just anger and sadness, honestly. But that first road, I'm grateful for, because it's meant that it's meant that mostly we don't have to think about her and what she wants, because what I'm interested in is people's, readers' relationship to a text, and the text is set. This is one of the interesting things about thinking about reading as a sacred text. And I should clarify for folks who don't know the podcast, we don't think about a text being sacred because, like, a god or someone says that it's sacred. We think a text is sacred when a community comes back to it to ask big questions about life and keeps on reading the text over and over and over again with the hope and with the longing that it might help us live lives of integrity and courage and love. And so it's that discipline and it's that community that forms around a text that makes it sacred. And so it has nothing to do with the author. And if you think about something like the Bible, to take one really obvious example, you know, the Christian Bible is a collection of many different letters and stories and poems and all sorts of things written by many different people. And it's kind of bookended together to make what we now think of as one text. It's actually many different ones. And I'm not interested in the Bible because I think, like, a white man with a beard in the heavens, like, sat down to write it one day. We know that's not true. What I'm interested in is the fact that there are generations of people who have asked big questions about life and used these stories as a sort of a mirror, not to learn what they should do, but to learn how other people have engaged this question and therefore might have some wisdom to share with us about what you can do or not do in this situation. So all of that is to say, thinking about J.K. Rowling actually has nothing to do with the way that we read the Potter books as sacred. That's road one. The second road is, exactly as you said, she's inserting herself in these really dangerous and cruel, just cruel ways. Like, there's a willfulness about her writing that is just, I mean, the essay was full of, as we all know, not just inaccuracies, but, like, there's a lack of footnoting. There's a purposeful misrepresentation. There's a constant manipulation, especially of cis readers, to make it sound reasonable, which is all the more destructive. So there's a meanness of spirit in it, So all I can say to the response that we said is, like, listen, if you need to step away from this fandom, if you need to step away from these books, please do. If you want to stay, if you want to stay engaged with these books in this community, we're going to make sure that we never recreate the kind of harm that she has. And we have to think about being even more intentional about centering marginalized voices, not just trans voices, but, as you said, voices of color, you know, disabled voices, all sorts of folks with identities that have been not just marginalized in our everyday lives, but have also been really caricatured and portrayed in nasty ways in the books themselves. So it's led us to ask really big questions and more deep questions about what it means to treat something as sacred. Turns out nothing is perfect.
Yeah. Well, I think that another takeaway that I have from what you're talking about is, you can't possibly know this about me, but I've actually been taking some divinity classes this summer. And
what?
I'm taking some this fall. I'm taking one at Harvard. I'm taking one at Wake Forest. And both of the classes I'm taking this fall are on Black women in the Black church.
Mm-hmm.
And And the reason I'm taking this class is because I grew up in a faith that centers, you know, the Bible as its primary spiritual text. And mm-hmm. also, you know, the Catholic Church is perhaps the greatest colonizer in the history yep. of, yeah. In human history. Mm-hmm. And I'm very curious to just spend some time listening to somebody who, you know, was never like their, you know, black female professors. And it's, mm-hmm. and it's, I'm just very curious to not like, because then I'm going to come back to the church. It's more so just, this is a text that was told,
yes.
you know, that it was told to me meant certain things, but here's a community of people
that's right.
who definitely can't believe those things because, you know, the Black church is rooted in Black liberation. So, mm-hmm. You know, it's a different center. And I'm very interested in just revisiting the same text with a different teacher. And I think mm-hmm. that's going to help me grow spiritually, but also that's like beautiful. Politically and civically. And I'm really excited to take those classes. Actually, one of them started yesterday. So that's all just to say that, you know, I think that that is something that as queer folks, we can access in a bunch of different ways. Like right now, it's not the Black church has been existing. You know, this is not, but that's not the tradition that I mm-hmm. had access to. And so yeah. what could I learn about what I'm supposed to do with the rest of my life from folks that have been working using even the same mm-hmm. text in a very different way?
Yes. Oh, I'm so excited for you. One of the great joys of researching the book that I put together was learning how, even with the same source text, different religious traditions will have very, very different rituals and practices. So when you look at the Black church in terms of the practices that are really central to it, it looks very different from mainline white or evangelical white or even Catholic white congregations. And so I'm so excited to learn from you what you learn in this class. And there's so many ways in which we can honor and learn from these traditions. And it's, I think even for those of us who might think of ourselves as non-religious, I do really believe that we all have, I'm going to use a very evangelical phrase here, but like that there is a shared inheritance in terms of what we can learn from spiritual practices and religious traditions that I believe are available for everyone. If we're in relationship with its custodians and if we do it respectfully and learn about its history, like there are ways in which we can participate in these traditions that are, I hope, liberatory for everyone. And that's my greatest hope is that, you know, fueled by that kind of sacredness, we can actually imagine and build new things that we never knew were possible.
Well, that is a perfect end. Look at that. 1 hour and 1 minute. I always try to stop like a little, like maybe 57, because I'm going to ask you one last question. But just so, congratulations to you for that final sentence. Casper, before I send you back into your day, I always ask guests to shout out a queero, which is a person, place, or thing that made you feel that you can be who you are today. Would you shout out a queero?
It's a very personal one, but it's my uncle's son, my uncle Alexander, my dad's youngest brother, who is gay and has been with his partner Jim for like 35 years. And I am so lucky to have grown up with a gay man as an uncle who was professionally very, you know, like he achieved lots of things in his work, but who was sweet and funny and loving and smart and personal. Like when I came out, even before I came out to my parents, like he wrote me this letter talking about how all these great artists in history were gay and that I was part of this great tradition and like part of a lineage that I felt like I could really belong to. And if I can have the same kind of sweet passing on of that to any future queer kids in my family or beyond, then I'm really, really grateful. So yeah, my Uncle Alexander has been a real not that we've been especially close as adults, but just that image of someone who I know and trust and I see as loved in my family. That was just such a gift.
Wow. I mean, that is also such a, what a way to welcome somebody to
right?
lay out that we are part of a yes. tradition and part of a history. Like that's what matters to me and what I think is so interesting. And I love that yeah. you had that experience. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for your time. It was lovely to talk with you.
Thank you for having me, Cameron. I hope we get to meet in person one day and just like
yeah.
high five and hug and consensually and non-COVIDly. and I hope you have an amazing experience with these classes that you're taking. And thank you for having me on.
Yeah, thanks for writing your book. I really think it's beautiful. And it was really nice to internet meet you.
Yay, internet friends. Bye. Yeah.